the sun and the moon. All of that summer, my feet never walked on the earth. She sang angels to rust. She sang angels to rust. How do you fall when you already fell for the past? She had that smile on her face when her thoughts were some other place. Oh, that summer, my feet never walked on the earth. She sang angels to rest. She sang angels to rest. How do you fall when you already fell for the
Richard Thompson to end this program here with She Sang Angels to Rest from Sweet Warrior. Ben Reynolds preceding that with Here Toucheth Blues. Hunt and Turner from a 1972 album called Magic Landscape. We heard Silver Lady. Espers did The Road of Golden Dust. Adrian Crowley gave us The Wishing Seat. Bertrand Gosselin with Détente. And John Hartford did On Christmas Eve. I'm Irene Trudell. Got to make way for Too Much Information with Benjamin Walker. Back next week at 3 o'clock. And this is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, on the web at WFMU.org.
I'm looking for a talking bird.
What kind of a bird you looking for?
The tallest one that talks.
Well, Amazons talk. They're probably one of the best talkers.
I'm wondering, is it possible to have a bird speak before I bought him to make sure he spoke the right things?
Well, all of our birds are hand-fed babies, and they're just kind of mumble, and some of them will pick up hello and what have you. And then from there on, it's up to whoever buys them to teach them what to say.
Well, see, the main thing, my problem is, I buy them, but I want to sure I get my investment back. So I want to teach him to be very witty so that he can form a talk show.
That would be the show of shows.
And he can interview animals. Birds don't have thumbs.
Yeah, but the way their feet are designed, they're just like thumbs. See, they've got two toes that face forward and two that face backward.
Maybe he could be a dispatcher for pizza or a truck driver because he could talk on a CB.
Yeah, but he couldn't reach the pedals.
Oh, I thought he had the opposable feet.
Most of my peers disappear. You know, you go to their websites and there isn't a contact click. You know, they withdraw. And something about withdrawing seems unfair to me, given what I said about the internet in the late 80s and early 90s. But something about withdrawing also feels appropriate given where it's gone. You know, given what it's come to. But we'll see. I mean, what I'm after now, and it's really weird to say this as I'm in my late 40s now. I'm thinking I want to get a job. I've never had a job. You know, I was a tennis court attendant for a while. I was a waiter for a while. I mean, early, but I never had a job.
I was bummed when Douglas Rushkoff put the Media Squad on hiatus because I was helping him produce the show. I'm Bill Bowen, and in some strange twist of fate, I'm now helping Benjamin Walker produce this show, Too Much Information, or as I call it, Too Much Benjamin Walker, in the same time slot. This week, the show is called Dead Media. We decided the best way to start the show is for me to interview Doug. So I did. I asked him if ending his show was a sign that small media ventures like the Media Squat just can't make it these days, and why he, of all people, doesn't have an iPhone.
The iPhone feels like the ultimate consumer device on some level, and it's just not a there's some piece of cultural baggage that goes along with owning one that I've resisted. But in resisting, I don't even know really what the joys of iPhoning are to some extent. It's just kind of where I finally just drew a line and said, okay, I'm not going there. And my nervous system hasn't adjusted to an always-on media universe. And I feel what it's doing is it's turning my media relationships into always-on relationships and my real-life relationships into asynchronous ones. Huh. And that doesn't feel... I don't want to make too heavy a value judgment on it. It doesn't feel healthy to me in that it doesn't promote my own sense of agency and wholeness and contentment and connection. And partly that is the iPhone-ness of being constantly pinged. And what I'm trying to do now is to figure out how to diffuse that. How much of that is just my own poor time management and inability to deal, and how much of that is organic to the highly technologized media universe we're in. I mean, what does it mean to get 700 emails a day? You know, well, this is what it means. I'm falling apart. Anyone involved in making any media today, almost anyone involved in making any media today, is playing on exactly the same playing field as AOL and Time Warner and Google. It's one landscape on which both Twits and NBC Nightly News occurs. So it's a lot harder to make that distinction. Say when you look at a local organic farm versus Del Monte, it's real easy to see the two different levels of operation. When the success of your blog is dependent on it getting linked from Huffington and in turn CNN, you're subject to the rules of mass scale. And that's tricky. You know, it's tricky. It's as if small media makers are now in the position that poets were in the 20th century. You know, almost no one, maybe Robert Lowell or Robert Frost and two or three others, no one made a living being a poet, even though you could still argue that the existence of good poetry is essential for the growth and development of the human species. You know, some people who can take language and create those sort of immortal and ineffably highly dimensionalized word clusters, you know, that's precious, that's sacred, that's real. The sad thing is, the more we need it, the harder it is to make it. You know, you do work on FMU and you're doing it for its own sake. You're doing it to support community and to do things. In other words, in a good economy, when maybe we wouldn't need it quite as much, I'd be in a much better position to take 6 to 10 hours a week and create good radio. But when I'm a dad and a husband, you know, trying to make ends meet by basically thinking, you know, thinking and writing, you know, in a world where thinking and writing are less and less valued, it's really tricky. But just as I don't have time to make a radio show that costs me 6 hours a week, who has time to do reading of 6 hours a week to get through a book in 3 weeks? You know, who's got that luxury now? There's this oppressiveness of the now, right now. I mean, it may be that there's enough redundancy in the news industry. I mean, when Tiger Woods, you know, comes out of his house to throw out the garbage and there's 40 news vans outside there, it means that there's 38 too many. Probably two news vans, two professional news crews could probably handle Tiger Woods' house. You know, so the 38 other ones, you could fire 30 of them and put 8 of them in Iraq.
In my theory of media, the key word is lazy. The CD beat the record not because it sounded better or because it was silver and not black, but because you didn't have to get off your ass to turn the record over. And let's face it, moving boxes of vinyl sucks. That's why, for me at least, the MP3 was the greatest thing that ever happened. Comic books were my only exception to the lazy rule. I just thought no one would ever want to read a comic book online. But recently, I discovered you can find a lot of great stuff on the internets, like cool, weird old comics and out-of-print graphic novels. All of it is illegal, of course, and a real problem for the publishers DC and Marvel, whose Batman and Superman comics now show up on the internet as pirate scans pretty much the day they come out in the stores. And even though these aren't the comics I like to read, I do find it fascinating that just as the good stuff is usually to be found in the back of the comic book store, the good pirate scans are buried in these subfolders on the pirate sites. The other day, I downloaded a new book called Sweet Tooth by cartoonist Jeff Lemire. It's a post-apocalyptic story set in a world where most of the humans have weird animal mutations. The main character, Gus, is a little boy with antlers. And when his dad dies, he hooks up with this mean, badass bounty hunter type character, and the two set off on an adventure across dead America. It's a brand new comic. The fourth issue just came out. But I liked it so much, I downloaded them all.
My name's Jeff Lemire, and I'm a cartoonist that lives in Toronto, Canada. And right now I'm working on a monthly book for Vertigo Comics, Sweet Tooth. It just seems endlessly entertaining for me to draw and write dialogue between sort of this young, innocent kid and this sort of gruff, grizzled kind of character. It just seems to write itself. And then in this case, I'm just taking it and putting it in sort of a science fiction adventure setting, because the post-apocalyptic, post-pandemic world and everything is obviously kind of timely right now, but that's really all kind of secondary. I started self-publishing my own comics here in Toronto, you know, just like photocopying and stapling them and sending them around stores and stuff. And then from there, I kind of got into doing sort of longer form stories, and I self-published my first graphic novel in 2005, I guess. And then from there, I hooked up with one of the smaller indie publishers in the States, Top Shelf, and we did a trilogy of books together. And then, yeah, from there it's been Vertigo, and I mean, Vertigo's a huge company. It's part of, you know, DC, which is part of Warner Brothers, and it's this giant corporation and everything, and it's a little more structured, but to be honest, they really give me free rein, and I haven't really had to change how I work or, you know, what I do at all. They're just kind of letting me do my thing. I've been cartooning for, you know, seriously cartooning for, what, 10 years now. And even when I had to work a day job, when I wasn't working with Vertigo and stuff, I would work at night, you know, at my day job. I worked as a cook, and then I would just draw all day, and I'd always put in at least 6 or 8 hours a day, pretty much every day. So comics is, you know, it's a really time-intensive medium to work in to begin with. So if you're going to take it seriously, you really have to put the hours in. So I think I was already sort of disciplined or trained to put in those long days. And so the transition really wasn't too tough for me. You know, I wake up early with my wife and kid here at home, and I start drawing usually around 8 in the morning or something. And I'll draw, you know, for like anywhere from 6 to 10 hours, depending what else is going on at home and stuff like that. And, my typical goal for myself is to do 2 pages a day, 2 finished pages of penciling and inking. That way I can do usually an issue of Sweet Tooth in, you know, under 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, which is pretty fast for, you know, normal DC or Marvel artists. Might take a lot longer, but you know, it's when you're writing and drawing everything yourself, you can kind of take some shortcuts and sort of do everything a little bit more organically than maybe the typical sort of assembly line system where there's a writer, a penciler, an inker, a colorist, and everything. And so, you know, it goes a bit quicker for me. You know, it's hard to know what to expect from the readership. I guess my dream or my goal would be just for me to be able to tell the story I want to tell and to be able to do the book for as long as I want to, which would probably be 2 or 3 years. And you know, if you're not launching a new book with Batman or Spider-Man in it, it's really tough to survive past a year or so. So, especially when it's something kind of idiosyncratic like Sweet Tooth, my real dream is just to be able to let it last for a couple of years at least before they can. I think the industry is at a real turning point. As far as digital, I think, you know, putting it out in sort of shorter installments online for people to read first and then collecting the good stuff would be how I do it. I just don't know. You know, I'm no businessman, so I don't know how I would end up getting paid from that. But,
you know, do you know if your comics are available like pirated scans on the internet?
It's funny. It's kind of, I'm a bit of a Luddite. I don't like computers, or I definitely don't like reading on screen, or but I haven't looked for them. But you know, I'm sure they're out there somewhere, but I haven't. I've never seen them or been told about it. So.
My name is Jeff Ayers. I'm wearing Forbidden Planet, New York City, on the corner of 13th Street and Broadway. It's Wednesday in the evening, and we're packed with new comics customers. Wednesday is being New Release Comic Book Day, which... it's like a little Christmas every week for people. You see people's eyes light up at what comes out. And we serve a ton, thousands of people on Wednesdays, thousands. So it's absolutely out of control some days. What I discourage about the aisle, the very jammed comic book aisle I'm looking at, is people right up on the shelf reading. I don't mind people flipping through. I'm really hesitant sometimes to say, hey, this isn't a library, because it stands to reason sometimes that if you read a book and you like it, you're going to pick up the next issue or something like that when you don't have time, or, you know, there's very different scenarios there. I do think that I do like to keep it clear so that people who are coming in want to, you know, see the full breadth of what came out this week. So we kind of stick the elbow out a little bit every now and then, just walk down and just say, gents, can you step back? Gents, can you step back? And just kind of swing it around. It's a good New Yorker move, you know? the people come in here Wednesdays, they're not the downloading crowd. I've gotten customers who come in and, you know, they say, yeah, downloaded that one already. Can't find that one, so I'll buy that one. You know, it's always usually on those guys. It's something that they can't find out there.
And does your elbow come out for that guy?
No. Actually, you know, the thing is, he's gonna pick up the stuff that he can't find on RapidShare. Say, you know, because, I mean, I've found certain things that I've been looking for, and certain things. I mean, when I've been doing things like that, sampling.
So, do you download comics?
I don't download comics.
Never downloaded one.
I downloaded comics once, okay? And it was for, we were doing a very rare store appearance and signing with Grant Morrison, which I was unbelievably grateful for Grant for doing. And I've been trying to get him to do it for years. And then the weeks pass, I thought, man, maybe we promote this by doing a huge collage in our front window of his comic books. And I going through my singles, which I wasn't going to tear up, and going through the store's stock, which it would be a lot of dough because it's a big window, I decided to download the entire Grant Morrison oeuvre up to that point.
Were you shocked you could just find it one click away?
It took forever, and we have a fast line. But it was incomplete, and I was like, this is nuts. I pulled out my comic book guy because this is nuts, the entire Grant Morrison oeuvre. I would take, you know, Spanky Pants 595 to task. I did. I was a little embarrassed, but I didn't tell him. I think I told him. I can't remember. I think I told him, actually. But I do think that I did feel a little dirty doing it. A couple years from now, or a year or two, somebody's going to latch on to everything. There'll be, like, a comic reader tablet, you know, a la Star Trek or something like that, a la Kindle, which is totally a Star Trek construct, by the way. You know, it's like a data pad, you know? Have you seen the damn thing? It looks like a data pad. I do think, though, people like information. They like stories told in book form, you know, because the tactile experience, there's no beating it. And it's really hard to read comics in the toilet or on the toilet from your unless you've got the data pad.
I've done it with the laptop.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan. Actually, it's funny. Grant was talking at something, and actually, I think he ripped me off because he was saying that, you know, I was on a Tron interview, and I was saying I'm a big Tron fan. Gigantic, actually. And I was saying that I was reading the issue of Tron in my bathtub, and it's kind of hard to do when you're bringing, you know, it's a little, you ain't bringing your iPhone to the bathtub, you know. So I take a bath, I read my comics, they get a little wet, it happens. But it's kind of hard to do that when you're reading online, when you're downloading, you know.
Is the comics industry aware that it needs a plan? Well, they are now. I mean, unless you're a total ninny hammer, you have to be.
Heidi McDonald writes about comics for the Publisher's Weekly blog, The Beat.
The biggest issue with existing comics publishers and digital delivery right now is what to do with the comic shops. Every time they try to do something that is getting current comics out there at the same time, which, you know, call it day and date in the movie industry, for everything dropping on the same day. It hasn't even been suggested. I mean, yeah. You can ask the question of comics publishers, which I have, and you get a big no, we wouldn't do that because comics retailers would freak out. You know, the music industry went through this whole thing where everybody was sitting and saying, oh, it'll never happen. Oh, I don't download music. And, you know, so nobody does. You know, the same thing. I mean, I've done a lot of interviews. And I should put together a quote gallery because I would have everybody, including myself, at various points saying, well, I like to hold it in my hands. Mm-hmm. So, you know, no one's going to download comics because I like to hold it in my hands, where, you know, clearly you have a huge piracy scene, and you have, you know, people reading comics on their computers, on their phones. I personally only read online when I have to. I don't do it for pleasure. I mean, I'm sitting here with Dashaw's Body World, an advanced galley of it. That was a webcomic that ran, and you would scroll down your computer screen to read it because it was done in a very innovative format. The book, I can flip through the pages, and to me, it's a more satisfying way of, if I need to see this, I just physically.
Did they make one just for you because they knew you wouldn't read the online one?
I think they made it for people like me, you know, and people like me are the people who are going to continue to buy the books.
I'd love for you to speak specifically about DC Vertigo here, and I know this might be hard, but do they have a strategy, and if so, what's it going to be?
Well, I'm not sure I can speak to that question. I would say as an observer, they do not at this point. No DC comics are available legally online, except for a few previews. I have heard various reasons for this, but they all come down to the level of scuttlebutt. So,
but hold on a second. As far as DC Vertigo is from having an actual digital implementation plan, they're also Warner Brothers. I mean, shouldn't they be the company that's learned from what happened to the music industry and actually be perhaps closer to having one?
Should one arm of a giant corporation learn from the problems of another arm of a giant corporation? Well, I think that's crazy talk.
My name is Richard Johnston. I write the Bleeding Cool website, which is a website about comics and comic-related news, rumors, gossip, whatever I can justify putting in there. And I actually wanted to write about the comic book pirates in a way. I guess that wouldn't actually get me into too much trouble. It wouldn't, like, you know, bring the wrath of the industry down upon me. But nevertheless, would at least explore, I guess, the social makeup of the people who pirate comic books and upload them. Well, basically, there are generally two main groups of pirates, one called DCP and one called Minutemen. And what these pirates generally do when they illegally scan and upload a comic book is that they put a kind of credit at the end saying who scanned it in. And they're very quite precious of these. Whenever a pirated scan is uploaded elsewhere without they scanned in without that credit, they get most upset. It's almost I think it's like a level of pride. And I just thought it'd be quite a fun way to talk about the pirates without talking too much about them and without glorifying them, but just to basically print their tags, their little kind of credits as a gallery. And I downloaded a whole bunch of comic books. And I scanned in the backs of all these scanned in comic books to get the credits, and I put them in a kind of a gallery. It's just a different way to look at the comic book pirates, not specifically as criminals, or not specifically as, you know, people fighting against the corporate copyright machine, but just looking at the work that they did, the artistic work that they did. So it's just a very different way to present that. And no one had done that before, and I don't think anyone's done it afterwards.
So let's take a look at some of these, and you know, just kind of wondering the psychological makeup. I mean, when you look at most of them, they look like kind of like live journal icons, you know?
There's a bit of that, yes. I mean, it looks like some of these could have come straight from MySpace. But there are some quite nice photoshopping work that goes into these pages. Oh, there's the one called the Minutemen Scans and Edits.
Yes.
Which is kind of like black with like a clock symbol, an eagle symbol, and something slightly like the spirit. And I think that just looks beautiful. And that doesn't scream 17-year-old to me.
Mm. What about the last Kryptonian with the Superman on his knees with his head thrown back?
Yes, that maybe a little bit closer.
What about Steam Scan? The guy, what do you think of his icon? Who do you think this guy might be?
Yes, the Steam Scan. Yes, he's taking a steam engine and put Steam Scan on it. So it's almost like his old fashioned kind of he's doing it by hand, I don't know. I don't think he's actually scanning in with steam. That'd be quite interesting. But
what do you think looking at this tag? We can sort of deduce.
Well, again, he's not a 17-year-old. Again, I don't really. 17-year-olds aren't really into uploading pictures of steam locomotives.
Steam is probably the scanner I've encountered most often. His tag shows up on a lot of books. In fact, he scanned Sweet Tooth. So obviously, I couldn't do this segment without him. And I spent the week trying to track him down on the internets, which was actually easy. because Steam has a Twitter feed. And so I started sending him messages telling him I needed to get in contact with him, but he wouldn't respond. So I kept searching. I joined a lot of comic scan groups, and eventually I found one where he was a member, and I started sending him private messages asking him if I could interview him for the radio show. But I got nothing. And so I started to panic. I mean, how the hell could I pull this off without him? The only idea I got was to use his Twitter feed as answers for my questions. So, Steam, how many comics do you scan a week? And what are your favorites?
Nothing new tomorrow because of Thanksgiving. Sucks.
You scanned the copy of Jeff Lemire's Sweet Tooth that I downloaded. Does that mean you're a fan, or do you also scan books you don't like?
Oh my f***ing god, I'm not a gaming group. I hate you all.
Obviously, this would have been a total disaster. But, thankfully, Steam wrote me back yesterday. He said he was too nervous to let me record him. After all, what he does is illegal, but he was willing to answer my questions via email. And thanks to text-to-speech and audio hijack, here is Steam.
A lot of people are surprised to learn how few new books I actually read a week. If I buy and scan 10 books, I probably read 3. Honestly, I can barely get through most superhero books these days. The first book that really blew my mind was Transmetropolitan. Someone I was chatting with online told me I had to read it, so I downloaded the issues. I then went on to buy a copy of every single issue, and all the trades for the series. I don't know if I would have bought them had I not downloaded them first. That was pretty much the start of me being hooked on Vertigo. Oh yeah, I also bought a ton of Transmet merch, including the Spider action figure and statue. I'm a sucker for good merch. Transmet is definitely my favorite book of all time, and I've tried to get as many people as I can to read it. Sweet Tooth didn't hold that much appeal, frankly, but as a general rule I buy pretty much every Vertigo book on principle. I think Sweet Tooth could be good, but it doesn't seem like it's gotten going yet. I feel like I'm just reading build up. The book needs to give me some kind of mission or goal, I guess, for me to get more into it. I had known I could get comics online for a few years before I ever really got involved in it. My first encounter would have been around 2001, but the scans were so small and badly done that it wasn't worth my time or effort. Internet connections were a lot slower too, so downloading them took some time. A few years later I went in to buy issue 4 or 5 of Son of M, the Quicksilver miniseries, and it had sold out. I was really unhappy, until I remembered that sometimes there were scans online. I went online, and within maybe 15 minutes I had the comic that the shop couldn't provide me with. If that comic store hadn't been sold out, it's possible I never would have gotten involved in scanning. I got to talking with some people in the chat room, and realized I had a lot of comics, and better access than many. How it works is pretty much how it sounds. You take the comic and scan each page into the computer, that's the first step. There are a lot of different models in play, but Epson seems to be a popular line among the comic scanners. I personally have the Epson V500. After you scan all the pages, then you need to edit them, or you should at least, in my opinion. Most people use Photoshop, though there are some people using GIMP and PaintShop Pro. You do the things you'd expect, straighten out the pages, crop out the stuff around the page, etc. Some people spend more time cleaning up each page than others, personal preference I guess. Truthfully, if someone spends a bit of time, the scan often looks better than the printed copy. For me personally, a scan lets me read the comic without the ads. I hate advertisements, and anything that lets me bypass them is great. It's hard to say what makes a good scan versus a bad scan. People have different styles and stuff. There are a few things, though, that I think most scanners agree on. Missing pages is bad, duh. Upside down pages, also bad. And when the image of the page is too big or too small, that's bad. Scanning each page takes about 45 seconds to 1 minute, but editing each page can take as little as 30 seconds, or it can take hours. I've spent hours on just 2 pages, trying to get them to look like a single image. I don't want to insult any of the other people out there doing scans. The one thing I'll say, if you take the comic apart, that is, remove the staples before scanning. A few guys have met each other in real life, sometimes meeting up at cons and such, but not a lot of us live very close to each other, so hanging out isn't that feasible. There have been fights. The scanning stuff has been going on for years now, so it was bound to happen. I'd rather not go into details on it though. Some things should stay buried. I guess in a nutshell, reputation comes down to three things. One is quantity. Duh. Next is quality. Like I said earlier, if the final project sucks, that doesn't help. And third is personality. We pretty much all know each other, and some of us have been at this a long time, so it's important to try to get along with everyone. I try, though I know there are some guys out there that probably find me annoying. But what can you do? Not everyone likes everyone.
So have you listened to the new show yet?
No.
I don't understand what I have to do to get you to listen. I've sent you like 50 Twitters.
No, shut up. I don't follow any Twitter. How long is each of them?
They're 54 minutes long every week.
That's like 50 minutes out of my day, man. Are you crazy? I could be whacking off.
Or writing a column. I met my friend Alex Beam about 8 years ago. He was trying out for the host job for this public radio program I was working for. He did not get the job. In fact, he was awful. I think I was the only producer who even liked him. But Alex hosted one of the most amazing radio train wrecks I've ever heard in my entire life. This was the summer of 2001, when Joey Ramone died.
There were all these f***ing Ramones running around. I couldn't keep them straight. I had no idea which one was dead. One of them was dead. That seemed to be important.
You were completely clueless.
It's, like, terrible. I'm in my own ridiculous world.
Alex, you have to help me. I'm completely screwed. For some reason, I decided to make the radio show about the media, which is retarded, because everyone knows there's nothing more boring than a media show about the media. But it's too late. The show is already in motion, so I need you to bail me out. You're a real journalist. Maybe you could just, you know, trash talk or something. It'll be fun.
What's the story? Is this, I mean, you have so much airtime to fill. You're probably going to put this on the air, these like weird ramblings. It's ridiculous. I'll just start reading from my Dom DeLillo novel. For WFMU, that would be very real. Well, I'm starting to like keep a file on Ted Kaczynski. He's a guy, I think he had the media down pat. He sort of understood what it was all about.
Yeah, what was his thesis?
I don't know. I'm trying to figure that out. Yeah, it's too bad he killed people, because otherwise I think he'd be a major, like, late 20th century media theoretician.
Well, I don't think I can get Teddy on the show. According to the prison warden, he's unavailable, so I'm stuck with you.
I don't think I have anything profound to share. I mean, you know, except my sort of, you know, disgust with media pomposity, which dates back to when I was in high school, actually. We used to read all the Boston columnists and marvel at how awful they were.
And is that when you decided you would grow up to be one?
I never knew I would grow up to be a Boston-based columnist. And my real disappointment in high school kids has always been that, like, you know, when they approach me as someone sort of, you know, worthy of emulation or should be looked up to. But when I was in high school, we wouldn't wipe our ass with the Boston columnists. We thought all columnists were full of shit. My friends and I were student journalists in 10th grade, and my friend was the editor of the school paper, and he got expelled, you know, for calling a faculty member a bad name in print. And I mean, we were sort of nihilists, you know. We didn't believe in anything, and we certainly didn't believe that anything printed, you know, in like a big city newspaper. I mean, it was mostly the columnists that we thought were so full of it. Now I realize I have sort of become one of those people. But I mean, I just like writing, you know, so they're paying me to write 725-word pieces a few times a week. And I enjoy doing that. That's a good way to make a living, I think.
It is a great way to make a living, and you have it actually extra good because you have one of those jobs for life, right, from the Boston Globe.
No, we essentially lost that this May. And we voted ourselves a fairly substantial pay cut this summer. So I basically make about 20% less than I did before. And it was like a bad summer for me. We're going to have more more buyouts in January.
Okay, see, there's something to talk about. Here you are, a hardworking journalist, you know, raising a family, and suddenly your job for life contract is unfairly yanked away from you. A sign of the end times for sure, but more importantly, Alex, how did that make you feel?
I couldn't care less. I didn't care when I had it. You know, I don't care now. I mean, they would do me a favor if they just shoot me in the back of the head. That'd be great.
One of the strangest things about dead media is that the sickness and the death only seems to fuel one of the scariest Frankenstein creatures that's ever existed. The Future of Media Conference. I've personally had the misfortune of attending quite a number of these, and it's always the same academics and the same people from the big media organizations that are currently sucking wind, pontificating to the audience about not sucking wind. A few weeks ago, I went to one of these at CUNY, and again, the main presenters were all from the New York Times, the newspaper that has now mortgaged its building to pay for its business. This conference promised to show off new business models for local news. But within 10 minutes, I'm being bombarded with bad PowerPoint slides of I don't even know what to call it. It was financial projection models of what you could expect if you went into the local news business. But it was all speculative, like journo math. And I'm not really good at math, so it was doubly hard to follow. But what I find so bothersome is that there are actual local news websites out there, especially here in New York, that are doing well, like Curbed, Brownstoner, Gawker, Gothamist. And while I'm not an academic, it does seem, perhaps, that you can learn more from case studies rather than speculative Excel sheets. Eventually, I tuned it out and, like everyone else in the room, loaded up the group Twitter feed, which is another annoying thing about these kinds of conferences. No one really pays attention to anything anyways. Everyone's online twittering to each other. And then I noticed that Jake Dobkin, the publisher of Gothamist, chimed in. Someone had asked him if he was at the conference, and he replied, no. But then he wrote another tweet, and there was a bit of a collective gasp from everyone around me. It said,
taking advice about the future of journalism from the New York Times is like taking advice about the future of the internet from pets.com.
So, Jake Dobkin, there is Gothamist, Chicagoist, LAist, SFist, which makes you the Rupert Murdoch of the ists, no?
Yeah, I'm the publisher, the person responsible mainly for selling the ads and dealing with the business end of things. But I do dabble, you know, with my partner Jen Chung and running the editorial. So I sort of, in a small operation like this, you kind of have your hands in everything.
So how did you end up doing this?
We started the sites in early 2003. We started Gothamist in early 2003. And it was just, you know, a kind of a lark for me and my friend Jen. We had met in college at Columbia. And, you know, we were just blogging about stuff we were interested in. And that was mainly New York City, interesting news, events that were going on, food stories, just kind of a potpourri of New York subjects. And I don't know, we started it just for our friends. And then starting in 2003, more people started to read it. Gawker was becoming popular around the same time. They were linking to us, and suddenly a lot of people who we didn't know were reading it, and that was, it kind of took off from there, you know. This was back in the early days of blogging when people would do it just for fun and for free. And you know. Yeah, I mean, this was like 2004, the dark ages of blogging. And, you know, if I had, there's no way you could start that today. You know, the first question everyone would ask is, how much are you going to pay me? And the second question, you know, would be, you know, what are my benefits? And, you know, back then it was just like, oh, we're starting the site for fun.
One of the things I find so interesting about your site is the tone. It's this very earnest, kind of wonky, friendly, public radio-y tone. You don't seem to go for the more popular, mean-spirited, who-can-we-mock-next tone of so many other popular websites. And I don't mean it in a negative sense, but don't you think that perhaps you could be, you know, more the media mogul if you took the snarky route?
I've always hated snark. I think it's like wit for, you know, retarded people. You know, I just think that it's really the lowest form of cleverness, you know, which is just to be mean. It's just so easy, you know, to kind of go over to the dark side, you know, especially in New York where, you know, we're just assaulted on all sides by, you know, a lot of things that make you kind of want to scream. And but we try not to. We try to maintain our sort of positive outlook. And, you know, we've been doing it for 7 years. And I can tell you, it's not a bad life. I'm a much happier person than I was 7 years ago. And I think very few people who have been writing and been online as long as I am could say that.
This is what really seems strange to me about you not being at these Future of Media conferences. I mean, not that I want to wish that torture on you, but seriously, why do they hate the IST?
It's almost like the sites like Optimist are kind of beneath their contempt, you know, where all you guys do is, you know, aggregate, you know, all you do is steal content from the New York Times. And it's totally not true. I mean, not only do we employ, you know, more than a dozen real journalists, many of whom have journalism degrees, and we produce dozens of original stories a day. I mean, you could call it a blog if you want or a website, but the truth is it gets more traffic than a lot of newspaper websites. I'm not going to name them for fear of starting fights, but and more traffic than a lot of the radio and TV websites.
You know, Jake, it seems that you are, you know, rightfully pissed that you're not being invited to play in the sandbox with the other kids. But it seems that I'm also hearing that you're angry because you actually have something to offer to the discussion.
I do, because I know how to do this, because I've been doing it now for, you know, for 7 years, and I have to pay my staff every month, and I have to pay myself, and nobody ever gave me or my partner Jen any money to do this. We started from zero.
You got no foundation grants.
No foundation grants, no VC, no nothing. You know, we funded it entirely ourselves, and we're profitable, which is how I think you have to do it to before you can call yourself an authority on it. Because it's really easy to run a business that loses $60 million a year, you know. And, you know, it's really easy to make $50 million a year, you know, and lose 60, you know. That's the easiest thing in the world. It's really difficult to, you know, to run a business that makes $1 million a year and actually makes profit. So,
well, I didn't leave the conference when I read your Twitter, but a few minutes later, a woman in the audience started shouting about how she resents being called a blogger because she's a journalist. And I did leave then.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. I mean, the only journalists who are going to survive are the ones who've mastered the skills of blogging. All that means is that they know how to produce content for the internet quickly, and they know how to produce a lot of it. So, you know, bragging that you're not a blogger is just like bragging that you're slow and stupid and probably don't know how to use the internet that well. And I don't know why anybody would brag about that.
My work in the Office of Information, part of the job is I end up going to a lot of hearings. right? I mean, I work on, you know, different stuff. Some of it's security, some of it's national telecom policy, things like that. And you know, we'll have hearings on that. They go up to the Hill. Usually I'm not the guy testifying. I'm there supporting, you know, the chief information officer. But I'm there, and I have to sit through these damn things. Usually, if there's a hearing that's about something legit, something that actually matters, no one from the media is there. You know, like, we go up there and we talk about national telecom policy, or we talk about the need for cybersecurity, these kind of things. No, there's no media there. They don't care. Why? Because it's like a real, it's almost like they hate anything that's real. This whole situation with the Salahis, the gate crashers, in fact, I'm surprised they're not actually calling it gate crasher gate. You know? Have you heard about this? I mean, this is like a full course meal for the press. I mean, this is the stuff they eat up for breakfast.
So did they have a hearing about this?
Yeah, they had a hearing that the Homeland Security Committee in the House had a hearing about it.
So how many reporters were there?
Yeah, like 200. It was ridiculous. He couldn't even get in the room. These guys with these huge cameras. This poor guy, Sullivan, the head of the Secret Service. I like him. He's a good guy. And the whole thing was like, basically, if you listen to the facts of what was discussed at that hearing, the facts were very simple. The Secret Service guy at the gate screwed up and let this woman through and her husband. He looked at the list. They weren't on the list. She sweet-talked them, and they were, like, you know, very well-heeled and all that stuff. They did go through the metal detectors. They didn't have any weapons. They were searched and all that. But they were just, you know, they just kind of bullshitted the guy, and he let him through. That never should have happened, right? That's the policy. Your name has to be on the list to get in. They should have just said, sorry, nothing I can do for you. You got to clear the path. I got other people to let in. But they just didn't.
Uh-huh.
They just let him in. That's it. And, you know, these people are, like, taking pictures, they're scribbling notes, and there's no story here. It takes 30 seconds to explain this story. And they're writing mad, taking notes, a million pictures. And this one guy sitting next to me, he's just scribbling notes, and he's turning to me and everybody around him asking questions about stuff that's like, you know, he's not listening to what's going on, and I'm getting annoyed because I'm at least trying to follow the hearing. I don't even want to be here because it's stupid, but if I'm here, I'm at least going to pay attention. And this guy's scribbling all these notes, but it's like I'm watching him and he's not writing down stuff that's actually happening or listening to what's happening. He's got his own little story like brewing in his head, and he's just there writing and talking to people and cracking lies and just all this stuff, and it was just ridiculous. So after the hearing, I needed a drink,
of course,
or like 10. So I go to this little bar like right off the hill. So I'm trying to chill out. I take the first sip of beer. I turn and look down the bar, and it's the journalist guy from the hearing.
Oh no,
the annoying guy that had been like scribbling all the notes. He doesn't see me though, because he's just still furiously scribbling in his notebook. So at this point, I'm just like, "F it, I'm gonna confront this guy."
So your hatred of the media is gonna result in a bar fight.
I would welcome it at this point. I was just like pissed. So I go up to the guy and I'm like, "Hey man, how you doing?" And he kind of looks up, "What?" And I said, "Yeah, how are you? I saw you at the hearing today." He's like, like, "Hey, you know what's funny though? I go to a lot of congressional hearings. I go to hearings about cybersecurity. I go to hearings about chemical plants. I go to hearings about telecom policy. I go to hearings about all kinds of stuff. And you know what? I've never seen you before. In fact, I never see any journalists there. You never cover anything that actually matters."
So you really were looking to just get in a fight?
Yeah, basically, I was just up in the guy's face.
And what does he say?
So this guy looks at me and he's like, "Well, man, I'd love to cover those hearings, but unfortunately, my boss has never let me go. So pardon me for trying to report the hell out of it. I mean, I'm just doing the best I can because I normally never get to cover a goddamn thing."
That must have blown your mind.
Dude, I was totally on my heels.
What did you do?
Well, I bought him a beer. You know? In fact, I bought him a lot of beer. So we hung out, we talked. I actually helped him write his story. You know, we've exchanged information, and he filed the story. And he's like a really good dude. I told him I'd help him. I'd be a background source for him. He actually wants to do some stuff on cybersecurity and the other stuff that I think is important. He actually thinks it's important too. So, you know, I think we actually ended up having like a really good exchange and a lot of beers. So by the end of the night, it's time to go. Bar's closing. We're going to go out and grab some cabs. And he says, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you, though, I guess, you know, with your job at the Office of Information, you have to know all about Operation Pravda, right? And I'm like, Operation Pravda?
What's that?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I'm like, I don't know. Operation Pravda, what's that? He's like, oh, you know the plan to bail out the media with government funds?
There's a secret government plan to bail out the media?
Yeah, there is. I hadn't heard about it. I didn't know about it at the time, but I've been doing some digging at work, and there is. We're bailing out the media with taxpayer dollars.
But why would the government do that?
I don't know.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Dead Media. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, and Bill Bowen. It featured Douglas Rushkoff, Alex Beam, Jake Dobkin, Jeff Lemire, Jeff Ayers, Heidi McDonald, Rich Johnston, Steam, and Chris Beck. There's even more information on the Too Much Information playlist page at WFMU.org.
I decided to start off the show maybe in an obvious way, but with Einstürz in den Neubauten, the Germans' industrial group, whose name, of course, means collapsing new buildings. And we're here. This is Mud Up. My name is DJ Rupture, and I'm here with special guest Jeff Minot of Building Blog.
Hey, Jace.
Hello. Architectural writer, thinker, and... yeah, I mean, I've known about it's. This show has been nice because I've been telling people, like, yeah, Jeff's coming on, and people who I had no idea they were interested in the built environment, you know, urban speculation, all these things, they'd be like, oh yeah, I know his blog. His blog's amazing, you know. so you're known and you're very welcome here. Yeah. So I guess what brings you to New York City? An open-ended question.
Yeah.
What are you doing here?
I mean, it's a pretty specific answer, but it's kind of a long story. But my wife and I have been living on the West Coast and basically put everything in storage in West Los Angeles and headed off this summer to go. I was teaching down in Australia for an architecture thing. And then we were traveling around Europe and we were in Rome for a little bit. And then we came up with this idea that, you know, hey, since everything we own is in storage, why don't we see where else we can go? And we decided that we live in New York and we put together a design studio. So it's an kind of an independent design studio with people from a graphic novelist, architects, a photographer, set designer, musician, filmmaker, and more. And we decided to tackle the idea of quarantine. So, you know, it was the summer of swine flu, and more people are finding themselves spatially separated from other people for medical reasons. And we decided that, hey, you know, maybe this is the moment for quarantine. And we'd focus on that, and we would produce stuff that would make people think about what it means to be involuntarily separated from other people.
That's fantastic. And that's one of the things I enjoy so much about your writing and your work is a very kind of voracious curiosity and a very wide interpretation of what architecture can be and what these sort of spatial considerations might involve, consistently challenging and sort of invigorating. Mm. One of the things you were mentioning on the walk over here, that's sort of a building bloggy topic, was cave mapping. That's some of the things you're up to this summer. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't cave mapping per se, but when my wife and I were in Australia, we drove out to the Blue Mountains, which are outside Sydney, and there's a place out there called the Janolan Caves. And they have these kind of, you know, everything from basic cave walks where you basically just, you don't even put on a helmet. You just, you know, walk around. You look at stalactites. But it goes all the way up to these kind of hardcore things where, you know, you put on the blue jumpsuit, you get the helmet, you get the light, et cetera, et cetera. And we went – so we signed up for an all-day caving thing. But